It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday. Today's guest is a Wisconsin-based cook who brings us the flavors of India built around six spices. First, Governor Evers called for changes to the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program in his executive budget proposal aimed at removing some hurdles for conservation projects. The changes would include a requirement that lawmaker objections to these conservation projects be made public instead of anonymous, along with relaxed rules for legislative review. The proposals come about a month after the Legislative Finance Committee blocked what might have been one of the largest conservation projects in state history. We're talking about the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program and the governor's push to make it easier for those projects to happen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on conservation projects in the state for this stewardship program? Should they require approval from state lawmakers? Do you have some of these in your community? Are you in a place where you think you might have too many of them in your community? There are some concerns in parts of the state. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Charles Carlin is Director of Strategic Initiatives at Gathering Waters, Wisconsin's Alliance for Land Trusts. Charlie, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's good to be here today.
Can you give us the basics on how the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program Fund actually works?
So the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program is Wisconsin's flagship environmental conservation program. And I think the most simple way to describe it is if there's a place outside in Wisconsin that you love, there's a good chance that the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program has helped protect it, improve it, and make it accessible to you. So since 1990, the Stewardship Program has provided grants both to the DNR, to local governments, and to nonprofit conservation organizations to acquire land for conservation. And then it also provides grants to nonprofits and local governments and money to the DNR for the infrastructure that we need to be able to get out and enjoy all the places that make Wisconsin special. So that's things like trails, boat launches, campgrounds, even simple things like restroom facilities at state parks can be funded through the stewardship program. So it's really done tremendous work. We like to say that more than 90% of Wisconsinites live within a mile of a Knowles-Nelson stewardship project.
Looking at the proposed changes in Governor Evers' budget, now this would all have to be approved by the legislature, which is never a sure thing. He would want to allow more projects to be allowed to happen without legislative approval, essentially, as I understand it, changing the dollar threshold that requires lawmakers to weigh in. What are you seeing there? How would that work?
So the way that the program currently works is any grant for more than $250,000 or pretty arbitrarily any project in northern Wisconsin that's north of Highway 64 goes to the legislature's powerful Joint Finance Committee for review. And that committee has 2 weeks to review projects. They can ask questions and they can do nothing, and that approves the project. Or they can raise an objection, and that effectively stops the project in its tracks. And so what Governor Evers is proposing is to raise that dollar amount up to $500,000 and also to require legislators to name themselves if they want to object to a project. By current practice, legislators can object anonymously. We don't know who objects to a project. We don't know why they object to a project. And even though state law is crystal clear that the Finance Committee is expected to hold hearings to discuss those grants, that rarely ever happens. And unfortunately, the legislature has really just increasingly weaponized this ability to object to projects. I was just looking back through data from the Department of Natural Resources, and since 2014, 43 projects have been held up because of objections from the Finance Committee, and only 14 of those projects ever received a hearing.
Let's bring on a caller now. Matt is with us in Chippewa County. Matt, hi.
Hi, I'm a County Forest Administrator for Chippewa County, and it's really important for Knowles-Nelson to support the counties when we are looking at land purchases. And the fact that we don't know who's objecting to our proposals is makes it very difficult to make the project successful. So I fully support the governor's changes.
Matt, thanks for the call. Charlie, what do you think?
Well, I can certainly sympathize with what Matt is saying. When an objection comes up anonymously and there are no public hearings, we don't understand what the objections are, and there's no mechanism to have a public debate so that concerns can be raised, a compromise can be reached. Instead, we're left with essentially rumor and innuendo from the legislature, and then misinformation can start to spread. You mentioned briefly at the start of this segment that the legislature has currently blocked the Pelican River State Forest in northern Wisconsin. And that's a private land conservation project. The land would be protected with a conservation easement. Right now, there's a major misinformation campaign that is spreading essentially lies about the project, saying that it's a public land acquisition, that it would take land off of the tax rolls. And because we don't have any public hearings about this, it makes it really difficult to set the record straight. And so simply having that debate would get us so much further along to being able to understand, are there legitimate concerns about projects? Can those concerns be met? And can we find some common sense compromises to help us all move forward?
Thanks for that call, Matt. We're talking to Charlie Carlin, Director of Strategic Initiatives at Gathering Waters Alliance for Land Trusts. Next up, we'll hear about what happens when the legislature doesn't support a big conservation project. Charlie stays with us. We'll hear from our own Danielle Kading, who's been following these issues. You can join in with your thoughts or questions, maybe a local experience, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the governor's proposed changes to the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program, spurred in part by lawmakers' rejection of what would have been the biggest conservation project in Wisconsin, the Pelican River Forest Project. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Charlie Carlin stays with us from Gathering Waters. And Danielle Kading joins us now, reporter for WPR, covering the environment in northern Wisconsin. She wrote about the Pelican River Forest Project and the latest Natural Resources Board meeting. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Just a few moments back, Charlie referenced that Pelican River Forest Project. Can you tell us a little more about what was going to happen and what did end up happening?
Yeah, so this was a project that would basically preserve 70,000 acres of private forest land across northern Wisconsin, and it would set it aside for recreational use and logging. And basically, last fall, the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board signed off on a $15.5 million conservation easement to preserve the bulk of that project. And it would be funded in part by a federal forest legacy grant. And the state would also have to chip in some funding through the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program in the amount of about $4 million. And this is a property that has 68 miles of streams and 27,000 acres of forested wetlands. And it's just a good link between the Oneida County Forest and the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest. And they say it would also support hundreds of forest-related jobs as well. And so the people and the Natural Resources Board that support this project really want to see it happen for those reasons.
But it sounds like this one was blocked in this process in the legislature.
Yes, there were some lawmakers on the state's finance committee that objected to this conservation effort. So far, Senator Mary Felskowski, a Republican from Irma, is the only one who has spoken publicly about her concerns related to this. She said that there were other members of the Joint Committee on Finance who were also opposed to the project, but she declined to name them. And basically, she said that she's not opposed to stewardship funding or the state owning public land, but basically, there is already a lot of public land in northern Wisconsin counties, and there's some concerns about taking properties off the tax rolls or taking it away from the private sector. You know, she would like to see some of these lands used for either development or, you know, related to housing needs in the area. And while this project does not take lands off the tax rolls, Felskowski argues that they would be taxed at a lower rate because they're enrolled in the state's managed forest law program.
So for supporters of this project, Danny, is this done? Are they looking for alternate sources of funding, trying to bring this back to get a hearing? Where are they now on the project?
I don't think anyone wants to see this project abandoned. Right now, about $3 million in stewardship funds have been obligated for this project. If that doesn't happen by June 30th, it could get rolled over into the next year. And if the committee ultimately denies funding or fails to act, the agency might have to launch a fundraising campaign or seek a landowner donation to come up with funds to match the federal grant that they have. That's paid for the bulk of this conservation easement.
Before I let you go, Danny, you've covered a related issue, someone on the Natural Resources Board expressing concerns that the DNR isn't funding maintenance enough of existing habitats that are protected in conservation programs. So what are the concerns there?
Yeah, board member Greg Kazmierski spoke about this at this past week's meeting. He's concerned there's not enough funding to manage habitats for wildlife as the state has added more properties under the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program. And he's concerned that if we don't set some more money aside for this, that basically we're going to have a quote unquote wildlife desert out there if we don't keep up with that. And the DNR has said that basically a certain pot of funding for habitat management has increased over the last decade by about $4 million. And so the costs are increasing. And so the question is, how do you support that or maintain these habitats without additional funding? And they want to see some potential support from the legislature around that.
Danny, thanks a lot for bringing this to our attention.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter, talking to us about the blocked Pelican River Forest Project and the latest Natural Resources Board meeting. Now back to Charlie Carlin with Gathering Waters, looking at the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program. With that big project, Charlie, that you had mentioned, that Danny told us about, the Pelican River Forest Project, what are your hopes now that, at least for now, that Knowles Nelson funding has been blocked?
Well, the Knowles Nelson funding has been blocked, but I'm confident that the conservation project itself is going to move forwards. As Danny mentioned, there's $11 million in federal funding on the table from the Forest Legacy Program. And the first part of the Pelican River Forest, about 12,000 acres, has already been conserved with Knowles Nelson stewardship dollars. Interestingly, neither Senator Felskowski nor any of her colleagues on the Finance Committee raised any concerns with the first phase of that project. What might be lost if the Knowles Nelson stewardship dollars don't come through is really the enhanced public access that state support can provide. So right now, as the plan stands, there would be 70 miles of interior roads that would be opened up and maintained for public access. And the current landowner, the Conservation Fund, would fund $1.5 million endowment to make sure that those roads are maintained in perpetuity. There are also plans to expand snowmobile and ATV trails on the property. And it's really the state support that makes enhanced public access like that possible. And so I think it would be a real shame to lose out on really those great benefits for the people of Wisconsin. I think whether or not the stewardship funding is there, there is so much support for the project across the state that folks will figure out how to close that gap. And we'll make sure that this land is managed for wildlife and sustainable logging, you know, into perpetuity.
Let's go back to our callers. Grace is with us in New Glarus. Grace, hello.
Hi. So what I'm wondering about is, why are these hearings on these funds apparently are not open to the public? And why are these legislators being able to hide from their responsibility to let the public know what they're doing? Don't we have sunshine laws in this state to help deal with stuff like that?
Grace, thanks for the call. Grace, referring to the ability of Joint Finance Committee members to anonymously block these proposals, Charlie, which the governor's budget proposal would. And it is like a quirk anyway in the way state government works, as I understand it, Charlie.
It's both a quirk, and the Joint Finance Committee is simply not following the law as it's written. So state statute is really clear that if a member of the Finance Committee wants to object to a Knowles Nelson project, they have to notify the DNR that a meeting has been scheduled to discuss the grant. Instead, the letters that the Finance Committee sends to the DNR simply say an objection has been raised and a meeting will be scheduled. And then, of course, they very rarely hold those meetings. So it is true that within state statute, there's essentially a loophole that allows legislators to object without naming themselves. And then the failure of the Finance Committee to schedule and hold those hearings means that legislators' positions never go on the public record. Proponents of projects never have an opportunity to speak up. And because votes are rarely held on these projects, a single legislator can stall a project when really I think the intent of the law is to allow a majority of the Finance Committee to put the brakes on a project if they have some major concerns. So in effect, what we have right now is the Finance Committee not following the law. And because they're not following the law, a single legislator can exercise an anonymous pocket veto. And I really share Grace's perception there. It's outrageous. It's an affront to basic principles of good democracy. And the governor's proposals are certainly a step in the right direction.
Thanks for the call, Grace. Briefly, as we wrap up, Charlie, would you hope for a public hearing process where local concerns, local objections could be raised, negotiated around, and you know people could find compromises if they see problems with particular projects?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the thing that we would like to see added to the governor's proposal is really clear timelines for hearings and votes. So, for example, if we said a hearing had to be held within 30 days and a vote within 60 days, and those hearings would be public, then those with concerns and those who are proponents of projects would both have an opportunity to make their voices heard. Legislators could debate the merits of a project, and they would vote on that project, and we would know where each legislator stands. And that would be a really crucial step towards bringing just some basic accountability and transparency and good governance back to the way the Finance Committee operates.
Charlie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That's Charlie Carlin, Director of Strategic Initiatives at Gathering Waters. He talked to us about Governor Evers' proposed changes to the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program. We also heard from WPR reporter Danielle Kading. Opioid overdose deaths are increasing across Wisconsin, and the Menominee Indian Tribe has the highest rate of deaths. But tribal leaders are working on new approaches to address the issue. Evan Casey reports on efforts by the tribe and its 8,500 members to curb that increase.
On the day her first son was born, Lighty Dodge's dad died of a drug overdose. Just 2 years later, her mother died from liver failure following a battle with alcoholism. Dodge was just 21 years old. She started taking prescription drugs to help deal with the grief. That quickly turned to illegal drugs.
I got really bad on heroin, and then heroin wasn't enough, so then I got really bad on fentanyl, and I got introduced to the wrong people.
Dodge is Native American and a direct descendant of the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin. She battled addiction for years while living on the tribe's Northeast Wisconsin reservation. She was in and out of drug court and treatment centers. But in 2021, she got clean. Today, she's 29 years old and 20 months sober. She says she wants to be there for her children.
Had it not been for them and my family and like the team that I had, I might not have made it, right? Like, this is my first time actually trying to get sober, right? Going to treatment, doing the things that I needed to do, and really setting, like, the foundation for my recovery to build.
Unfortunately, Dodge's story of addiction is not unique to her. National stats show Native Americans experience higher overdose death rates than other racial and ethnic groups. Overdoses among all races soared during the COVID-19 pandemic, and they haven't declined yet. Many of the deaths involve fentanyl, a drug 80 to 100 times stronger than morphine. That's something Wisconsin's Menominee Indian Tribe is trying to fight. Menominee County has the highest overdose death rate in the entire state. Last year, the tribe saw a record 16 overdose deaths. On a sunny Monday in January, a group of tribal officials gathered in the reservation's community center for a meeting of its new drug intervention team.
Welcome, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get going with our drug intervention team meeting here.
Police Chief Keith Turtelot is on the team. He says the issue is so bad, his officers are getting burned out from all the calls they're going to.
It's a common situation that we go from one overdose to the next to the next.
The chief says police regularly give out the overdose reversal medication, Narcan.
But we need to make sure that we can get to them and get them into treatment and get them help, and that's what this whole organization is about.
The team is working to coordinate efforts with law enforcement, as well as to increase prevention and treatment efforts on the reservation. They're also working to get more recovery coaches. They'll be available through a 24/7 hotline. Addie Caldwell is a member of the team and the director of the Manisakio Wellness Center. She envisions the coaches as the initial contact for someone who is seeking to get clean.
They're our first stop. They're the first person that's going to meet with someone to figure out where that person is at, what that person needs, and then kind of tailor what they are doing to fit what that person needs.
In a phone conversation, Caldwell said the issue often starts at home.
You know, we have multiple generations sometimes in one household, and if one person is struggling with addiction, that potentially is being seen by, you know, younger kids.
Today, Lighty Dodge is living in Shawano and working as a recovery coach for others who also want to get clean. She has 5 boys and a 6-month-old daughter. She says she's encouraged by the work the tribe is doing. She's now attending meetings of the intervention team.
I want to show people, right? It is possible. It's possible to do it, like to get through probation, get through recovery, to do these things and get turn your life around and really do it, right? And not just say you're doing it.
Tribal leaders are making progress on many of the new initiatives they started to discuss last year. Just 2 weeks ago, many of the new recovery coaches met for the first time. They're hoping to make an immediate impact. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Our guest today tells us how to make healthy, fuss-free Indian dishes using 6 key spices. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's been 1 year since Russia launched its widespread invasion of Ukraine. Our guest says the war marks a new era in the international order. Now it's Food Friday. If you've ever thought about making your own Indian-style food at home but thought it might be too complicated, our guest has good news. You can create great flavors starting with a collection of 6 spices. She says with these 6 base spices, you can make Indian dishes that are healthy and can be made without a lot of difficulty. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite Indian food? Is there a specific Indian dish you've been wanting to try making yourself? If you cook Indian food at home, what's your go-to spice? If you grew up eating Indian food, if it's part of your own family's traditions, love to hear from you and maybe your own cooking advice. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ruta Kahate is a chef, restaurateur, and author of 3 cookbooks, including 6 spices, 60 dishes, Indian recipes that are simple, fresh, and big on taste. Her newest restaurant, Ruta's, will open in Walker's Point in Milwaukee this May. Ruta, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into the 6 spices themselves, and when I think of Indian food, I think India is a really big place, and there's a lot of different food traditions. You have a really unique story. You experienced a lot of those different traditions moving around India in your childhood. Can you talk about that and how it figures into your cooking?
Absolutely. Yeah, my dad, he was in the Ministry of Finance, so he got transferred a great deal. And we literally went to 4 corners of India, wherever there was a currency note press or a mint, we would be posted there. And my family was very into food, and we would embrace whichever community or culture we were placed in. And so I grew up with lots and lots of flavors and different cooking techniques, different ingredients. Very, very lucky to have a childhood like that.
And part of your mission with this new cookbook and your previous one, Five Spices, 50 Dishes, is, you know, if anybody's out there thinking, I can't cook Indian food, you say, yeah, you can. Could you give us a pep talk?
Yes, absolutely. I love that. Yeah, so Indian food, you know, as you mentioned, it is a very, very ancient, very vast, influences and differences from different parts of the country itself, which is geographically different. So, yeah, where do you begin? and having, you know, restaurants in the West kind of, you know, I mean, they have restaurant-style food. So you get this impression that all Indian food is that, you know, either heavily sauced or very complex, all of which Indian food can be. But what is the food that is easily accessible to people? And this is the kind of food I cook when I'm at home. I use minimal spices and still get the same flavors and nutrition just using, you know, five or six spices. So my entire goal with all my books has been to demystify Indian food. What I like to call simple but not simplistic. So it's not dumbed down, it's just simplified. So you're able to cook. Some of my recipes here have maybe just one spice or no spice at all. And it is possible to be very, very unmistakably Indian, even with that in that recipe.
All right.
So, you guys can do it.
Let's meet some of the spices. Now, I'm going to say the list, and then we'll pick a couple here. Oh, you've got cayenne, coriander, cumin seed, mustard seed, turmeric, and the new addition is asafoetida. Now, I'm going to cheat. I'm going to pick my favorite spice to cook with and to eat is cumin seed. Just used it last night, actually. Talk about cumin seed and the flavors it adds and the different ways we can use it.
Okay. So cumin belongs to the parsley family, and it has a sort of a peppery taste that, as you say, it's, you know, a little bit more widely known. There are many ways to use it. You can use it just raw, like, you know, and if you're going to use it just like as a whole seed raw, I recommend kind of crushing it in the palms of, you know, both your hands to release the oils and the flavors. Before you add it to whatever it is you're adding it to, you could use it toasted, either dry toasted or toasted in oil, to where they release their, you know, qualities into the oil, or you can use it ground. So there are many ways to use this, and several of the recipes kind of demonstrate these different ways. And the other thing is Indian food is based on Ayurveda, which is an ancient form of living, really. That's what it kind of means, the science of life, but which is very much involves food. And spices are used there to help nutritionally. And cumin is a great digestive. So it's added to foods to make them easier to digest. But we also use cumin just to, you know, help with digestion. I mean, Indians are known to walk around with whole spices in their mouth. And I have taught my children to chew like a teaspoon of cumin after a particularly heavy meal to help with digestion. You can even make a tea with cumin. Just boil some water, add some cumin seeds, let it steep, and then you just sip that all through the day. And that just will help, you know, aid things along.
We're talking to Ruta Kahate, chef here in Wisconsin. Her new cookbook is called Six Spices, 60 Dishes, Indian Recipes That Are Simple, Fresh, and Big on Taste. You can join the Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite Indian dish you've made yourself, grew up eating, encountered in a restaurant, or maybe a friend of the family? Do you have questions about using the spices we're talking about? A favorite of those spices on that list: cayenne, coriander, cumin seed, mustard seed, turmeric, asafoetida. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ruta, I want to key in on the spice you added from your previous cookbook. Now, there's Five of those spices, I think, are household words here in the United States. You've added out asafoetida to the repertoire in the new cookbook. Can you tell us about that spice?
Sure. So Five Spices was written almost, I'm thinking, 16 years ago. It was pretty popular. It just went out of print after, I think, four runs. Just recently went out of print about a year ago. And so I've waited for those many years to add this sixth spice, only because it really wasn't known. And even now, I mean, it's still a little bit unknown, and that's kind of what I'm hoping this book will do, is bring it to the light a little bit more. But I did check before I wrote the book, I did check that it is available. It's available on Amazon, at, certain health food stores. So asafoetida is a resin of a ferula herb. It grows, it's taproot, and it grows in the northern regions of India and Afghanistan and that area. And it's a wonder spice. So it is available in rock form in India. There are different, actually, shades of color and, type. But the one that you get widely in the West is in a powdered form. And it's also, by its name, you can tell it's fetid, so it doesn't smell too good. It's also been called devil's dung. So it's a very strong smelling odoriferous spice, but it's a magic one. And what it does, and I don't know how to politely say this, but it basically removes gas from the ingredients, but from your body as well. It makes things super easy to digest. So Indians will use it without fail in any bean preparation, or if you're using it in cruciferous vegetables, specifically for that reason. But the other great thing about it is that it tastes and smells, once it's added to hot oil, it will taste and smell like garlic and onions. So it's used, that's the flavor profile. So, and then there are communities in India that don't eat aliens, or they don't eat these stronger ingredients like ginger, garlic, onion. Asafoetida helps with those reasons as well, So it is quite the spice. And if you know how to use it, and which is where the book comes in, I think you'll be very pleasantly surprised.
It's Food Friday. We're talking with Wisconsin chef Ruta Kahate about her cookbook. It's called Six Spices, 60 Dishes, Indian Recipes That Are Simple, Fresh, and Big on Taste. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you'd like to join in, do you have a favorite Indian food you've tried, maybe had at a restaurant? You want to try to recreate it at home? Do you cook Indian food all the time? Do you have a question for our guest about how to use these spices most effectively? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've got a few recipes that Ruta shared with us. They're up at WPR.org/Food Friday coming out. We'll check out one or two of them. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with chef and restaurateur Ruta Kahate about her latest cookbook. It's called Six Spices, 60 Dishes, Indian Recipes That Are Simple, Fresh, and Big on Taste. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you have favorite Indian dishes to eat and or to cook, if you have questions for Ruta about how to make things, how to use particular spices, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ruta, you shared some recipes with us. We've got them up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's check this out. Yogurt soup with dill. Tell us a little bit about this recipe. Ruta, are you there? Hearing a phone signal, not our guest right now. We'll try to get her back on the connection here in our Food Friday conversation. Meanwhile, I'll highlight those recipes. That soup I just mentioned is at WPR.org/Food Friday. along with jicama and mango salad, and spicy red pickled chicken. Find all those recipes at WPR.org/foodfriday. Then try to make them at home and let us know how they are, how it goes. And you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. While we try to reconnect with our guest, a big thank you to everyone who gave during our winter member drive this year. So great to hear from so many of you. As we said during the drive, you really do make a difference with your gift, and we really appreciate everyone who joined in, maybe for the first time, maybe for the third time, and of course to all the sustainers out there. If you're wondering what I'm talking about and you missed out, well, you could still give if you want to over at WPR.org. Again, that's WPR.org, and look for a how to donate there. I think we have Ruta back. Ruta, hi.
Hi. Great. Okay. Sorry about that. That's okay. What happened there?
Okay. So that's fine. We've got this yogurt soup with dill recipe. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So yogurt, you know, soup. How do you make yogurt into a soup without curdling it? but Indian recipes abound with just that. So the trick is to kind of have something to emulsify it, whisk it without actually getting it to curdle. So we use chickpea flour, and it's like cornstarch, but without, you know, I don't know. I mean, I find it much more nutritious to use chickpea flour. And the idea is to have yogurt. Basically, Indians base a lot of their cuisine on dairy. And yogurt is eaten at almost every meal. And in the winter months, you make it into a hot soup. So here, what we do is we pretty much emulsify the yogurt with lemon juice, the chickpea flour, water, so you thin that out, a little bit of salt, a little bit of sugar, and the two spices, which are turmeric and cayenne, to give it some flavor and also the nutritional aspects of turmeric. And then you're going to give it a little bit of a hot oil dressing with two more spices. So you can heat a little bit of ghee, or which is clarified butter, or a little oil of your choice. And then when it's warm enough, you're going to add mustard, whole mustard seeds and whole cumin seeds. So this part is a little tricky, where you don't want your spices to burn, but you don't want them not to bloom, which means that they pop open and release their flavor. So the book kind of helps you through that, you know, hold your hand through it, where you heat it up just right, throw in your spices, let them sputter, and then very quickly you're going to add it to the simmering soup, which really, you know, aside from giving you all the flavor profiles, but it's also imparting the nutritional aspects of the spices I talked about earlier, and warming up your soup really well. We do finish this off with dill, which a lot of people, you know, some folks don't like dill. My kids cannot stand it. They don't want dill in their soup. So, you know, you totally can keep it out.
Can I do cilantro instead of dill if I wanted to?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, any herb, actually. Parsley will do. There is no reason not to use. And this is the other reason this book, one of the reasons this book is so precious to me, because I'm trying to get people to cook Indian food, not just as a special meal, but with, you know, try to incorporate it into their regular repertoire. So yeah, throw in parsley instead.
We are having a Food Friday conversation with Ruta Kahate. Her new cookbook is 6 Spices, 60 Dishes, Indian Recipes That Are Simple, Fresh, and Big on Taste. Let's bring on a caller. Judith is with us in Milwaukee. Judith, hi.
Hi, I'm laughing as I'm dialing you in. I'm making split pea gal right at the moment, and using, I think, 4 of the 6 spices that your guest has been talking about. So I have turmeric and cumin and coriander. I put in some ginger, and then I added a spoonful of curry powder from Penzies, which is really delicious curry powder, and it could have just put in 2 spoons of that and left everything else out, but I like having my own mix in there.
Judith, thanks a lot. We'll be by for dinner in a little while. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Aruta, thoughts on making a doll? She's using a split pea doll. A lot of times people use split peas or lentils of all shapes and sizes and colors, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So doll, again, one of those, you know, basic necessities on an Indian table. I have a split pea recipe in this book as well, where I try to sneak in vegetables in any which way. And, you know, so mine has, I think, zucchini and green beans added to it. Yeah, dals are, again, dal is a very generic term. It could mean the whole bean. It could mean a split legume. It could mean the cooked product. But, you know, without dal, I think life is just, you know, sort of it's an unfinished thing. So, yeah, you can use any number of beans and make a very delicious dal. A lot of the recipes in this book, you could substitute dals as well. You don't quite have to stick to, if you're an expert and you have a bunch of dals in your pantry anyway, just mix and match.
Thanks a lot for that call. Enjoy the meal. Ruta, I wanted to bring up one of your points or your suggestions at the beginning of the book is to have a coffee grinder, electric coffee grinder that uses your spice grinder. So the chef late Floyd Cardoz was on the show about 7 years ago, and he had a book out then, and he persuaded me to do that, and it is so amazing. I'm addicted to like grinding up cumin and other spices in it. Can you talk about the benefits of taking those whole seed spices and grinding them up as opposed to using, you know, buying them in, say, powdered cumin form?
Absolutely. So, yes, you must. And I would suggest having two. Don't use your, you know, regular coffee grinder unless you want cumin flavored coffee in the morning.
My wife wants me to be really clear. Like that one over there is for coffee. The one in the drawer is for spice. Don't mix them up.
Right. Don't mix it. But if you do mix them up, here's a quick little trick I use. Just raw rice. Grind raw rice in the spice grinder, and it should clean it up and take that, you know, any leftover odors away. But yes, please, please buy your spices whole as far as possible. The only ones I will allow you to buy ground would be cayenne, because no one's going to like you grinding up your own red peppers, or turmeric, which is hard to come by whole. So turmeric is a root. It's part of the ginger family. And usually they're, you know, very rarely available whole in root form, and they're very hard, so they might even test your spice grinder a little bit. So those are okay to buy ground, but cumin, coriander, any of the other ones you use in your pantry, cloves, cinnamon, try and get them whole. And if it seems like they're hard to grind fine, a good trick is to just toast them very lightly, or put them in an oven on a very low, like 150 degrees or something, just to kind of warm them up so they lose any moisture that they've gained by just sitting in a cupboard, and grind them fine. And by doing that, not only are you getting the entire potency of their flavor and aroma, but also their nutritional, you know, they're all little nutritional bombs, you know, so you don't want to, having them sit out, they just turn into sawdust, really, if you've ground them and kept them for a while.
Ruta, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Ruta Kahate, a chef, restaurateur, author of 3 cookbooks. Her latest is 6 Spices, 60 Dishes, Indian recipes that are simple, fresh, and big on taste. Her latest restaurant, Ruta's, will open in Walker's Point, Milwaukee. That's scheduled for this May. Find a few recipes from Ruta over at WPR.org/Food Friday. What, we got some spicy red pickled chicken, jicama and mango salad, and then that yogurt soup with dill we talked about. Or sub in other herbs if dill doesn't sound so good to you. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, lawmakers from both parties join the show with their reactions to Governor Evers' two-year state budget proposal and a look at the road ahead to a state budget. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network.